This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
So I was fooling around on Facebook last night, and I came across somebody had posted reviews in major media outlets of the Beatles' famous Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And three out of the four reviews were horribly negative, except for the one in the New Yorker. Now, I understood, and I made fun of this, you know, when the Beatles were the new mop tops and they were singing I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You on the Ed Sullivan Show. I can see where the fuddy-duddy media establishment would say, you know, who are these kids and what's going on here? Like, that I get. That was their debut in the United States. But Sgt. Pepper's, I'm sorry, all these people, and it was, you know, it's hard to explain now when everybody's kind of hip, but there was, you know, the Beatles were part of this emerging counterculture, and, but the people who ran the major, you know, undoubtedly all sort of, you know, middle-aged men, major media outlets, they were not too hip. They were, you know, stiff-necked. They were, you know, the parents that kids of my age made fun of. But, you know, looking back, what a historic blunder. I mean, Sgt. Pepper's is the album that changed rock music forever, that stretched the boundaries. Not that it was perfect, but it was just revolutionary. You know, from the theme song, you know, they were dressed up as this kind of dance hall band, to A Day in the Life. I'm revolutionary. Now, of course, I'm biased. I'm a big Beatles fan. But I remember at the time, like, nobody could believe it. It was such a different kind of music. So maybe some of those people, I'm sure most of them not still alive, but if any of them are, maybe they have updated their opinion. All right. Hope you have a good weekend coming up. Media Buzz, 11 Eastern on Fox on Sunday. Making some changes as we speak. Here's an item about Harry and Meghan in London Sun saying these whiners are to stop making royal bashing fly-on-the-wall Netflix shows. The British spell it as if it's whinging, but I don't know if that's how it's said in the UK. You know, this is not exactly a fair and balanced article. To huge relief, they are also banning any more moaning memoirs 1,240 days after their Megxit. Instead, these self-pitying Sussexes, how do you pronounce that? Sussexes, there, that's better, will only feature behind the Netflix cameras. The drastic decision to stop their TV and book sniping will spare the royal family future pain. The couple has lashed out at King Charles, Camilla, William, Kate. But it turns out, according to this piece, they've run out of material to the relief of audiences around the world fed up with their whining. One insider told The Sun, that period of their life is over as there is nothing left to say. Now that might be the real disclosure here. They've spilled their guts on all of the, you know, whether you like them or not, whether you think they went through a terrible time or not, whether you thought Megxit was justified or not. It's probably played out. They've made a zillion dollars. They're living in California. You know, they don't have to do this anymore. Okay, so last night was the hour-long Donald Trump town hall in Iowa with Sean Hannity as the moderator. Hannity said at the beginning, you know, unlike the CNN town hall, it's not my job to debate you. And look, they've known each other for 30 years, as Hannity said. Both Hannity and Trump were making the case against Joe Biden. But there was an interesting point, because it had to do with whether or not President Biden has the mental acuity right now, forget about second term, to do the job. And Trump said, you know, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this. I actually called Sean, and I asked Sean not to joke about it, because he used to joke about it until 2021. Hannity regularly joked about Biden's sippy cup on the show. Trump says, I said, honestly, I don't think it looks good for you or anybody to joke about it, because it's a serious problem. I said, I just don't think it's good for anybody and not appropriate. You can speak about it if you want, but I don't think you should joke about it. And you really didn't after that. And Hannity said, well, now I now realize how serious it is. It's not that Hannity still doesn't denigrate the president's mental abilities. But it was interesting. I mean, here's Donald Trump, you know, Mr. Bomb Thrower, Mr. Insult, makes fun of Ron DeSantis' name, telling Sean Hannity to tone it down. Now, there was a question from Hannity about the story that's been just, you know, dominant, broken by CNN, all over MSNBC, all over the big papers, about the tape recording in which Trump, a couple of years ago, talks about having a classified document, I wish I could share it with you, with the war plan to attack Iran. And it's not just one of these theoretical, you know, let's see if we can invade Canada or Australia. It's, you know, General Mark Milley really was pushing this idea, at least until the end of the administration. So Hannity says, there's a special counsel that's appointed, and news broke yesterday, there might be a tape recording that, quote, where you acknowledge that you understood that these were classified documents. First of all, do you know who this call may be with? Do you know anything about it? Trump, no, I don't know anything about it. All I know is this. Everything I did was right. We have the Presidential Records Act, which I abided by 100%. Well, first of all, almost by definition, he didn't abide by it 100%, because all of these secret and top secret documents that he took from the White House are the property of the U.S. government. Whether you think he did anything wrong is another question. And by the way, the Wall Street Journal, I guess, has reported that Special Counsel Jack Smith is wrapping up, or in the final stages of, his investigation of the classified documents. And this tape, I mean, Hannity says it's a call. It's actually a book research meeting for former Chief of Staff's Mark Meadows book. And anyway, at the town hall, President Trump then goes on to say, you know, this is all because my polls have gone up. Wherever my polls go up, you know, they try even harder to get me. So he never really grappled with the question of classified records or this tape-recorded conversation. Let's move on to story number one. So last night, the Senate approved the debt ceiling bill that the House had passed. It now goes to President Biden, who, of course, is going to sign it. And I'm sure there'll be a big ceremony, and, you know, the president will finally sort of get his moment to claim at least a share of the credit. You know, I was watching a couple of Democratic senators, including Tim Kaine, who are like, I must offer this amendment dealing with the pipeline that he doesn't want in his state of Virginia. Tim Kaine was saying that, but knowing full well that if they start offering amendments and there's any change in the bill, it has to go back to the House to be approved a second time. And then Biden would get to sign it. And the clock is ticking. I mean, seriously. A couple more days and we go into default. Fortunately, that was averted. I never thought there'd be a default. I've been telling you this for months. I've been saying that Joe Biden and Kevin McCarthy would find a way, no matter what they had to do, to avoid a catastrophic failure by the federal government to pay its debts. Remember, this is all past spending. Anyway, the final vote in the House was 314 to 117. In the Senate, there were 63 votes for the compromise measure. Biden said Wednesday afternoon, we're going to deal with the debt ceiling. I think things are going as planned. And so finally, it passes the Senate last night, and Biden puts out another statement. Now, again, he'll be before the cameras, but this is why I've been on this sort of kick about Kevin McCarthy sort of owning this process, because he was there every single day in the Capitol talking to reporters. Washington Post, the House vote served as validation, allowing McCarthy and Biden to show they could pull off a critical bipartisan feat in an era of hyperpolarization. I don't disagree with that. McCarthy appears to have survived the process without a serious challenge to his speakership, at least for now. Biden will not have to ramp up his election campaign amid a calamitous defeat, not to mention what this would have done to the economy. But a lot of people are now sort of, you know, it's spin time, okay? We're not going to default. President's going to sign the bill. So let's, each side should declare victory. And so it was all, you know, Morning Joe was all about, I think the headline was, Biden crushes extremist elements. You know, the truth is they both did. The Speaker and the President stood up to the most ideological members in their own parties. Okay, New York Times. President Biden steadfastly refused to boast about what he got as part of the agreement. He told reporters, why would Biden say what a good deal it was before the vote? You think it's going to help me get it passed? No. That's why you guys don't bargain very well. I don't know how he knows that, but President calculated that the more he bragged that the deal was a good one for his side, the more he would inflame Republicans on the other side, jeopardizing his chances of getting the agreement. His reticence stood in striking contrast, says the Times, to his negotiating partner, Kevin McCarthy, who's been running all over the Capitol in recent days, asserting the deal was an historic victory for fiscal conservatives. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. He did get significant spending cuts. Why wouldn't he brag about it, given that he had such a tight margin to work with? While Biden knew that would aggravate progressives in his own party, he gambled that he could keep enough of them in line without public chest beating, and figured it was more important to let McCarthy claim the win to minimize a revolt on the hard right that could put his speakership in danger. So they're now saying this is all by design. And I guess this is the spin the White House is putting out, because here's Matt Bai, columnist writing in the Washington Post, saying, I can't recall another moment when a president achieved total victory. Well, it wasn't a total victory. And then tried to pass it off as a painful compromise. That's what President Biden did when he delivered a remarkably one-sided win on the debt limit. And it tells you something about how he intends to run for re-election. I know that's not how some on the left have portrayed it, says Bai, but in their never-ending quest to make the almost perfect the enemy of the perfect. If anyone tries to tell you Biden's deal with McCarthy amounted to a betrayal, like some kind of legislative Yalta, you shouldn't listen to that person. So why is the president acting like he just played Republicans to a lengthy draw rather than an obvious checkmate? Well, for one thing, the White House badly needed the deal to pass. So it was deft to let McCarthy portray it as more of a mutual win than it actually was. But this signals that Biden knows what got him elected and that he intends to revisit this theme in 2024. What made Biden president wasn't a grand vision for more activist government, although he certainly has spent many trillions of dollars as president to pursue that. What made Biden president was a promise that he could make government work in some recognizable form again. Now, look, if this had fallen apart, if there had been a default, the president would have been blamed. So it's fine for others who were very supportive of Joe Biden to claim credit on his behalf. But here's the thing. There's another element to this, which is looking like you're engaged. And I've talked about this before. Kevin McCarthy was the face of the debt ceiling negotiations because he talked to reporters at the Capitol every single day. Biden, maybe, you know, two times a week. And remarkably, I still can't wrap my head around this. On Saturday night, when they finally made the tentative deal, McCarthy's there hailing it to reporters. And Biden at Camp David puts out a statement. Remember, a president always has a pool with him. He could step in front of the cameras at any time. He didn't end up speaking to reporters, and it was just a few quick questions until Sunday night. And again last night when the Senate passes it, like, now we know it's going to become law. So I don't understand quite why Biden was so reticent, but they're now trying to turn that into an asset.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Story number two, you've undoubtedly already seen this footage, maybe many times. Joe Biden tripping and falling after giving a speech at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs yesterday. So he was, you know, in fairness, he's standing up there for an hour and a half, you know, congratulating all of these graduates, helping to hand out diplomas. And then he turns to walk off the stage, and he trips on a sandbag, and it was a nasty spill. I mean, he fell to his knees, got himself up. He was fine. Later hit his head on the, top of the plane or something. But it looked awful. And whoever put the sandbag there with an 80-year-old president should be court-martialed. I mean, what a dumb move. And it's not fair to Biden. But, of course, those who say, I remember Rich Lowry writing like Biden was one terrible fall away from his reelection bid being in trouble. Well, fortunately, he wasn't hurt. He's fine, said communications director Ben LaBolt. There was a sandbag while he was shaking hands. And then this New York Times piece goes into, you know, other presidents who have fallen. I mean, Gerry Ford was lampooned on SNL a zillion years ago because he tripped several times coming down the plane stairs or whatever. And Donald Trump, who was asked about this at the town hall, you know, recalled how he was shaky when trying to come down a wet ramp after he gave a speech. He didn't quite fall to his knees, but he looked very shaky. So he said, look, the Biden thing looked bad, but he didn't choose to go crazy about it, I guess because he's been there. It was at West Point. So it was actually, must have been around the same time of year. For Biden, already America's oldest president, says the Times, asking voters for a second term, the stumble is likely to add to questions about his physical condition. And look, it's fair. I don't think we should overplay it, we in the media. I think it could have happened to anybody, especially after standing for an hour and a half. The White House doctor has acknowledged that as he has gotten older, Biden's gait has stiffened. So he walks slowly, less steadily. And it's, you know, it contributes to the impression that he's not physically robust. I mean, you know, the White House aides will tell you, you know, he works out every day and so forth. He's very fit. He's got energy to make it through long days. He exercises every day. He's not overweight. That's true. And Biden even joked about his age. He said, when I was graduating from high school 300 years ago, I applied to the Naval Academy. And then later he told reporters, I was sandbagged. And he kind of was. All right, number three. This is a piece in National Review about the Ron DeSantis campaign. And, you know, he's been out there this week, Iowa, New Hampshire, eventually ends up in South Carolina. That might be today. And this is fascinating. In the week since Florida Governor Ron DeSantis launched his presidential campaign, political observers have been forced to witness a bizarre martyrology. I didn't know that was a word. You never know. Frustrated by the governor's penchant for stonewalling them, reporters have taken to bombarding him with superfluous questions, which the governor responds to with amused indignation, if he responds at all. It would be a footnote to the campaign if these reporters didn't promote these episodes online with video evidence of the interactions with DeSantis and the mistaken expectation, says National Review, that it makes him look bad. It doesn't. The theme here is that it makes the reporters look bad. So, AP reporter on Thursday in New Hampshire, that would be yesterday, now that I think about it, governor had just given a speech, and people were coming up to him. And this reporter, Steve Peoples, said, asked DeSantis, I saw the video, why haven't you taken any questions from voters so far? And DeSantis snapped at him. He said, people are coming up to me, talking to me. What are you talking about? Are you blind? Are you blind? People are coming up to me. I think he was right. I mean, look, what you're trying to do, if you're a reporter, is get some kind of response out of DeSantis, who doesn't take a whole lot of questions from the dreaded mainstream media. But so then, you know, the AP reporter himself, you know, posts this online. NBC News, you know, had a camera there. This was not an attempt to ignite a fabricated war with the press for the benefit of the media-hating Republican primary voters. DeSantis was not visibly flustered. I think he was really annoyed, in my humble opinion. You know, he could have handled it with more humor. What are you talking about? And I guess that was his attempt to handle it with humor, but he seemed pretty annoyed. Nor were DeSantis' support in the room put off by his conduct. What we are privy to here is a banal exercise that goes beyond basic campaign work. Politico columnist Jonathan Martin acknowledged this, said the larger problem with his reaction is it shows he still doesn't grasp the bad will he's courting by, in this case, lashing out at one of the top reporters for the AP. So to reporters, it's personal, this piece says. Then it deals with Tara Palmieri of PUC. She spent a day following DeSantis around, tried to get some questions to him. She reported that the governor seemed almost to be running away from me. DeSantis' people posted a video of the questions she was asking. I am Italian-American too. Does that matter to you? Why are you against Disney characters? Which is your favorite one? And what else did she ask? Why won't you meet or will you meet with Disney CEO Bob Iger? How do you think The Little Mermaid is going to do at the box office? What about the 6-week abortion ban you signed in Florida, refusing to speak with the press? I mean, look, it's a mixture of light questions and serious questions. The journalistic establishment seems to be operating under the flawed assumption, again, wrapping up the National Review piece, that their hostility toward the governor is both justified and requited by DeSantis. From the outside, however, these look like cloying displays in pursuit of the attention the governor won't give them, not out of antipathy, but out of ambivalence. I don't know. It's an interesting dilemma. We know full well that Ron DeSantis is a very low opinion of the national media and some in the Florida media as well. But if he were to take some questions, he would make news. It wouldn't just be his stump speech. And he's taken a lot of shots at Trump. And, you know, I said this on Special Report last night. He should have done this months ago and not let Trump define him. When I started saying that, DeSantis was leading in some polls or was down by a few points. Now he's down 30 points, 40 points. Although, obviously, national polls don't decide a presidential election. But look at Trump. He can't stand the media. And he talked about, DeSantis looked really bad getting mad at the press. This is Donald Trump saying this. But if he were to just sort of swallow hard and take some questions, I think he would get his message out to a broader audience. Now, he doesn't want a complete broad audience. He wants Republican primary voters. But still, I think it's a missed opportunity. The governor is following a different strategy, and that's his right as a candidate. And this is me as a podcaster throwing in my two cents. All right, number four, piece in the Atlantic. Every successful politician follows roughly the same path. First, they become prominent on some stage. They become more successful, maybe graduating to a larger stage. Then, eventually, they peak and decline, with the affection of even their strongest supporters cooling somewhat. If they're lucky, Harry Truman, George H.W. Bush, they eventually experience some historical revision that burnishes their reputation. And that has happened both in the case of Truman and the elder Bush, in part because of books that were written years after they'd left office. If they're very lucky, they even live to see it. If they are not, Herbert Hoover, Richard Nixon, they don't. This happens when a politician's departure from office comes in defeat at the polls or at the top of their popularity, as with Bill Clinton, who has seen his reputation suffer personally and politically in the past 15 years. Well, there's a different view among the public and the press of his relationships with women, and one former White House intern in particular that led to his impeachment and ultimate acquittal. Along with election results and norms of basic decency, Donald Trump continues to defy this pattern. I thought this was a broader piece. How does everything end up being about Trump? Not only was the former president nationally famous before he entered politics, but he's always been unpopular with most Americans and very popular with his base. From early in his presidency through the present, nothing has changed the picture. That stability is now the key to understanding the race. Okay, enlighten me. The prospect of a rematch between Trump and Biden has demoralized and baffled commentators. Not Biden versus Trump again, said the political scientist Sabato's crystal ball, run by Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia. It won't be pretty. It may not be inspiring. And it will mostly be about which candidate you dislike more, says Doyle McManus of the LA Times. Washington Post Megan McArdle. How did a once great nation end up facing an election between two very old, very unpopular white dudes? How did we end up with that? Although, you know, it's kind of assuming we're going to have this rematch. Not a bad bet at this point. But who knows? I was asked last night in a special report, you know, why isn't Biden debating? What I said was, he's the incumbent president. He flies around on Air Force One. He doesn't have to debate. He can just be president and make news, although he doesn't make full use of that bully pulpit. And, well, what about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? He's at, you know, 16% in polls, or one poll had him at 19%. And I said, you know, he's an anti-vax guy. He's a protest candidate. People who aren't happy with Biden, you know, tell pollsters, oh, I want RFK. I mean, obviously, he's got the great family name. Or Marianne Williamson. So Trump says he's not going to debate, at least initially, if he's 30, 40 points up on his rivals. And of course, President Biden is not going to debate. You got to apply the same standard. All right. So, in the very next paragraph, here is Kennedy's name, illustrating the dissatisfaction among Democratic voters. I think that's fair. Trump is a more interesting case because he is not president, has never successfully won the popular vote, also true, lost the previous election, also true, to say nothing of his attempt to steal the election afterward. These are the ingredients for a politician to lose support and slink away. There was no popular groundswell for Gerry Ford to run again in 1980 or George H.W. Bush in 1996. Only op-ed contrarians, such as Doug Schoen, clamored for Hillary Clinton to run again in 2020. Yet Trump hasn't lost luster, partly because he never had much luster to begin with. More than half of Americans have disapproved of Trump since early 2017 or held an unfavorable opinion of him. But the people who love him, love him. The people who like him are loyal. That isn't changing. And just to wrap up this Atlantic piece, one explanation, DeSantis hasn't been a very good candidate. He looks clumsy and leaden on the trail, in the opinion of the Atlantic writer. He's failed to differentiate himself from Trump in a way that appeals to enough voters. Okay, he's been campaigning for a week. Doesn't make what this article says untrue, but, you know, you got to give him a little time. That's encouraged other Republicans to make a plan for the mantle of Trump alternative. Trump alternative hasn't emerged. because most Republicans don't want a Trump alternative. They want Trump. The depth of affection for Trump is appalling, okay, Liberal Magazine, given that his first term in office was morally and practically disastrous. I think you get the point.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
And here's a sort of a different angle on it for story number five. Politico media writer Jack Schaefer, who increasingly seems to want to write about politics, starts off his piece this way. Who asked Nikki Haley to run for president? Can somebody introduce us to the gentle persons who convinced Tim Scott to enter the contest? Is anybody outside of his family and his congregation urging Mike Pence to join the Republican field? That will happen next week. Same applies to Vivek Ramaswamy, Chris Sununu, Chris Christie, also getting in this week, who've been flashing their presidential dance cards at voters. Have any of them stopped to consider the deleterious effect that having a swarm of candidates in the race might have on the outcome? Just to quote myself one more time, and I think probably this now amounts to plagiarism, but I said we've all seen this movie, this 2016 movie before, when I was talking to Shannon Bream last night, which is lots of candidates split the anti-Trump vote. So Schaefer goes on to make the same point about 2016 when he recalls that the other contenders included Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, John Kasich, Jeb Bush, Ben Carson, Chris Christie, Carly Fiorina, Rand Paul, Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, Jim Gilmore, George Pataki, Rick Perry, Bobby Jindal, and Scott Walker. I'd forgotten that some of them had run. Bobby Jindal. That didn't work out too well. The pileup made it difficult for individual candidates, other than the provocateur Trump, to distinguish themselves. In the first candidate forum, voter attention was split 11 ways among 11 candidates, forcing them to talk in sound snippets before the camera swung to the next contestant. Sounds like a reality show. Many of the candidates held duplicate views, further stymieing efforts. For example, you had the Republican normies, Kasich, Christie, and Bush, selling the same formula. Meanwhile, the real right-leaners like Santorum, Huckabee, Perry, Walker, and Jindal dittoed one another on the issues. If you had asked a voter to submit to a blind tasting of their views, it's unlikely he could tell them apart. Wouldn't it have made more sense for, say, Kasich, Christie, and Bush to huddle and consolidate the normie faction? Trump didn't walk away with the nomination, as we kind of recall. He was the plurality winner, not a majority one. He got 45% of the vote, lowest since Dukakis in 88. Had a thinner field been running, perhaps one real challenger would have emerged and given Trump a tougher fight. Interesting. But you know what? I mean, it's just in the DNA of politicians. They don't step aside. They don't say, you know what? You're at 20% in the polls. I'm at 2% in the polls, so I won't run. I'll support you. They all look in the mirror and think they see a president. And so it just goes against the political instincts. Absolutely goes against the political instincts of people who get into the politics business. And we could well be looking at a replay here. And maybe it doesn't matter. I mean, if Ron DeSantis, who's clearly the number two, can't get within, I don't know, 10 points of Trump or finish unexpectedly strongly in Iowa or New Hampshire, then he's not going to win the nomination. Trump's got a big lead and a big personality. And, you know, DeSantis is out there talking policy. He loves to talk policy. It's his strong suit. He knows it really well. He's immersed in policy. But is the Republican battle going to turn on that or personality, more specifically, the overwhelming personality of Donald Trump? Well, it's that time for me to wish you a good weekend and remind you about Media Buzz. Always appreciate the chance, especially with so much political news today. I left a couple things out. We'll come back with that in the next edition of this podcast. So have a great weekend. See you on Monday with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.